Mrs. Davy, Mr. Gewurz.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Robert Gewurz. I represent the appellant, John Vasey. If I might, I would address my oral arguments to two of the arguments, the first and the last, and we would rely on the brief on the others, subject to any questions that you have. The first argument is whether or not the evidence was sufficient to prove a proper nexus to interstate commerce for the charge of arson against the single-family dwelling. And whether you call this a jurisdictional argument or an element of the charge standard, the nexus has often been called the jurisdictional element of that statute, and it is that jurisdictional element that is missing. When the Vaseys moved into this home, it was a home that was owned by people named Nass, who had to leave in a hurry because of his job required him to relocate, and he was trying to find quickly a buyer for this house. It was a single-family house. He was renting it until he could sell it. In fact, his testimony, it was clear that I was only trying to cover my mortgage. They had a lease agreement with an option to buy. Under Jones versus United States, the property must be used in interstate commerce or affect interstate commerce. This property was not used in interstate commerce, and it was not affecting interstate commerce. He was trying to sell that house. He couldn't do it that quickly. He rented it until he could sell it.
Well, that's Jones, but there's also Russell. So what is the rule you're advocating?
I guess the rule I'm advocating is that you have to follow the Jones definition of, you have to look at the purpose of the structure. If it's a structure...
Wait, no, that's obviously wrong, right? Because the purpose of all residential structures is residence. So you're not going to say that some international business in renting properties is not in interstate commerce because they're residential.
No, and I would say if Nass was in the business of specking houses, if he was in the business of buying and selling houses that were not, he was not living in, then I would say those would be affecting commerce and interstate commerce. The difference in Russell and this, Russell's an apartment building.
That's why I ask you, what is the rule you're advocating? Do you want to have a rule that distinguishes between apartment houses and single-family homes, or what?
I would say that rule has to be what's that purpose and use
of
that particular structure.
We've been through the purpose. The purpose of an apartment house, the purpose of a single-family house is the same, right? So that can't be the rule.
Well, no. The purpose of an owner of an apartment house is to make money.
Yes, and the purpose of renting a house is to make some money, right?
But you have to look at the use and the way it's being used, each particular structure.
The structures are being used for the identical purpose, to house people.
Yes, the use for the purpose of the people living in the house is to house the
people.
And
the purpose of the renter is to make money, whether he's a big renter or a little renter, rentier.
Well, he specifically said that the purpose that he was renting was just to cover his mortgage.
Well, of course. you rent
the purpose of being in the business of renting the Empire State Building is to make enough money to be able to eat. And therefore the purpose is to eat, and eating is not, and so on, but that won't work.
Well, but the purpose of sending gas into that house is for making money for the gas company. And the courts have held that that's a de minimis nexus to interstate commerce. What's the difference?
The question on the table is whether you think that the right construction is one that distinguishes between single-family and multi-family dwellings, between rental and owner-occupied dwellings, or that distinguishes a single dwelling according to its use at the time it is torched, as opposed to the long-term use of the building. All of these are, I suppose, conceivable. The question you're being asked is, which of these are you arguing for, and why?
I would say that the use it was being at the time of the arson by both the person living there and the person
Why? Okay. Why is the use at the time of the arson dispositive? Let me give you an example. It's actually Russell's example. You have, say, a four-unit rental dwelling. The owner causes everybody to leave, and then as soon as they leave, the owner torches the building. At the time of the arson, it is unoccupied and no one is paying rent. Does that take it outside of Russell, and if so, why?
No.
Okay, so you've now just told me that its use at the time of the arson is not the dispositive feature. That leaves us with two others.
Well, no, because the use at the time was still, the purported use of that building was an apartment building to make money, whether the owner told everybody to get out.
In my hypothesis, the building is vacant, and the only way in which they're planning to make money is to burn it down and defraud the insurer.
Well, at the time that it's vacant and he's not gaining rent, then he has gone against the original purpose of that building.
Buildings don't have purposes. They're inanimate. They rarely think for themselves. People might have purposes.
And the owner of an apartment building, his purpose is to make money, to make a profit, which I would consider commerce. In this case, the contract that they had listed them not as a tenant, not as a lessee, it listed them as a purchaser. And what I'm saying really is the connection in this house to interstate commerce is no different than a single-family dwelling owner having an out-of-state mortgage, having an out-of-state insurer, because it's not affecting the use of that property. It's still being used as a single-family dwelling, and the fact that the Nasses were out of town trying to sell it and couldn't sell it in time and therefore were using the rent just to cover their expenses until that could be sold is a de minimis nexus to interstate commerce. In fact, their contract was a contract of purpose, and the rent they were paying would go toward the purchase price if, in fact, they bought.
But that was
Now I'm even more puzzled. I thought when you started that you were making a legal argument about the scope of the statute, because after all, this was raised by a motion to dismiss the indictment. It wasn't raised by a motion for acquittal at the end of the case. If your argument is based on what the record in this case shows, you needed to make a motion for a judgment of acquittal. All right? All we can go on a motion to dismiss the indictment is the sufficiency of the indictment. Now, how does your facts of this case argument mesh with the kind of review we're supposed to be conducting?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, I think I made a motion to dismiss, and then at the end of the evidence, I made a motion for acquittal.
The only thing that's argued in your brief that I could see was the motion to dismiss the indictment.
Well, Your Honor, frankly, I don't see really that there is a difference. The
There's
next
an enormous
difference.
Difference.
I may move on to the next argument. That is the sentencing argument. It's our position that the defendant was improperly sentenced because the court could not apply the homicide guidelines to the fraud convictions. And when the court applied the homicide guidelines to the fraud convictions, the court impermissibly gave a sentence beyond the statutory maximum, which is in violation of a precedent.
I don't understand this argument. Your client got a succession of multiple 5 and 10 year sentences running consecutively.
Right.
Was any of those sentences in excess of the statutory minimum?
Each one?
Statutory maximum?
No.
And it's pretty clear, the circuit has said, Apprendi had nothing whatever to do with consecutive sentences. So what's the problem?
Well, because the consecutive sentences that were applied here were applied under 5G1.2.
Yes.
And 5G1.2 allows a district court to basically go outside the Chapter 3 grouping rules to apply consecutive sentences on top of each other as many as they want
No, not as many as they want.
Well, to achieve...
Only as many as the defendant is convicted of.
No, to achieve what the court considers the total punishment.
The defendant has to be convicted of them before he's exposed to a sentence under it.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Well, what's your objection to the length of the individual sentences or the fact that they were made consecutive rather than concurrent? Well, what would you regard as the proper sentence here?
I would consider grouping the fraud counts together, consecutive with the arson count, if the arson count stands. But I don't see how you can give...
So your objection is to making the fraud sentences consecutive?
16.
What's the basis for that? Okay.
Because under 5G1.2, a court can give those consecutive sentences to achieve what is called the total punishment. But how do you achieve, or where do you find what that total punishment is? It seems to me, if you're looking at Note 14
if you have a homicide, you look at the homicide guideline.
But you can't look at the homicide guideline.
Why not?
Because it violates Apprendi.
Well, I don't know what it has
to do with the guidelines. The whole of Apprendi, as we've said to her, blue in the face, is that you cannot exceed the statutory maximum without determining beyond a reasonable doubt those facts that are necessary to do so.
Absolutely.
No statutory maximum has been exceeded.
The statutory maximum for fraud is 5 years. Note 14 does.
But there are multiple frauds in consecutive sentences, right? One fraud, 5 years, but there are many frauds here.
But I think you're putting the cart before the horse. I think first you have to determine what a legal total punishment is for each fraud count. 5 years.
5 years.
Then
he was convicted of a lot of them.
He was. And then you have to go by the grouping. You can't go to 5G1.2.
But that isn't an Apprendi. You can see,
that's
don't you? It's not an Apprendi issue.
No, I think it's an Apprendi issue because 5G1.2 says first you have to determine a total punishment. The total punishment...
Apprendi is about what you have to submit to the jury. Is your complaint what? What would they have submitted to the jury here?
Well, granted there was no murder verdict form under the federal statute, but they could have submitted a special interrogatory. Do you find beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant, John Vasey, committed the offense of murder?
It's not necessary. The Supreme Court has said that for guideline purposes, you can take into account other offenses even if your client was acquitted of them.
True.
Apprendi is about statutory max.
True.
Nothing exceeding the statutory max here.
Let me ask you about another issue. The actuary, what is your objection to the actuaries, what, the 1 in 1.7 trillion probability of...
My objection to that is that it basically is putting a mathematical probability on guilt or innocence.
Well, do you have an objection to the calculation or just to having statistical evidence in front of a jury?
No, the objection is not to the calculations or to his qualifications. It's just putting that number before the jury.
Well, what if there were fingerprint evidence or DNA evidence, and you questioned it, and a witness testified that there was only a 1 in a million chance that these were not your client's fingerprints? Would that be improper also?
Yes. I don't think under DNA, for example, I think they can make a calculation like that. That is a scientifically provable. I think fingerprint evidence, they can say either in their opinion it is or it isn't. But to give a jury a number like this...
But what do you mean it is or it isn't? How does that deal with the probability? Suppose there's a 1 in a million probability of fingerprint, you know, confusion, coincidence, mistake. So what do you tell the jury?
Well, I don't think that evidence in fingerprint would come in statistical.
The entire basis of fingerprint evidence is statistics. Actually, the founder of modern statistics, Galton, did the work that led to the use of fingerprints in court. There is no basis for fingerprint evidence other than statistics.
Well, the statistics are that when they find a certain amount of matches, they make an opinion that it is...
Right, but they're not infallible. They certainly can make a mistake, although there don't appear to be any authenticated instances of mistake, but they can make a mistake. So if you, as a defendant's lawyer, wanted to say to the jury, well, yes, they found my client's fingerprints, but, you know, could be someone else's, they could have made a mistake. Would it then be proper, by way of rebuttal, for the government to present a witness who would testify that, you know, it's only a one in a million probability of a mistake?
I don't think it would be proper.
But then you could cast doubt on the reliability of fingerprint evidence, and the government could not rebut you?
Well, they'd rebut by putting as many witnesses on as they want to say these fingerprints match.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mr. Lang?
May it please the court, my name is Patrick Lang. I represent the appellee of the United States. And I also will only address the issues that were brought up. The test that Judge Eastbrook was asking, I think, was delineated in Russell when it said that in an activity that affects commerce, it's unquestionably the rental of real estate is unquestionably an activity that affects interstate commerce. Russell,
but is that the activity that was at stake here? I mean, let's suppose a particular dwelling, make it Judge Posner's home, is rented for 3 months while he's off on summer vacation, and he then comes back, occupies it full time as he has for more than 30 years. And at some time an arson occurs. Is that home within the scope of Russell or within the scope of Jones?
Well, it happened during the summer when he was on vacation and he was renting it. I would argue it's within Russell.
And then he comes back and it's burned down by arson a month after he comes back and is occupying it again.
It's Jones then. I mean, the house, as you said, is not...
So your answer to my question is that a particular building drifts in and out of the federal arson statute restlessly, depending on what it's doing at the moment it is torched. And then, presumably, you think Russell itself was wrongly decided because the building in Russell was vacant when it was burned down and nobody was paying any rent.
No, I don't think Russell was wrongly decided, Judge.
All right, but then your answer to my question is wrong. The building doesn't drift in and out of coverage.
Well, you're talking about a single-family house. I believe you were talking about with Judge Posner. You have to look at what it's being used for. An owner-occupied house that's not being rented, it's been occupied by the owner, under Jones, is not in any activity that affects interstate commerce. You have a building that is normally a commercial building or an apartment building as in Russell. And there is, and I may be wrong about this, but a short or brief time when it is not being used, it's not going back to where Judge Posner is now living in a house, during that period of time, it still could be argued to be in interstate commerce. In this case, certainly on January 14, 1998, 342 High Street was in interstate commerce. It was being rented by Desiree Basie from Larry Nass, who resided in Arizona.
What about Mr. Gavert's intervention on this, that this was really an option to buy?
Well, there was an option to buy, Judge.
And the agreement was not, quote, a rental or lease agreement.
Well, it was a lease
agreement.
I'm sorry, Judge. It was a lease agreement with an option to buy. The option could not be exercised for a year, and the arson took place well before that took place in January, and the option would have kicked in September, and there's no telling whether they would have exercised that option or not anyway. But at that time, it was clearly rented. You know, judges, we had another arson that we charged, which was an arson that took place in Galena, Illinois, which was count 18 of our indictment. And we dismissed that count, just for the reason that it came within Jones. It was an owner-occupied house. And so we dismissed that count. We felt quite strongly that the Carey house was within Russell, as the court also found. I think Jones, you know, when Jones made
it, I think
it
a career arsonist would be in interstate commerce. I mean, it's not that, I don't know if this works, but you have a scheme to defraud that, I mean, clearly he does this on a repetitive basis, and the arson is the, well, he's defrauding insurance companies, that clearly is interstate commerce. The arson is the means by which he defrauds the interstate, defrauds the insurance companies. So, couldn't you argue that that kind of arson, an arson that is a part of a scheme to defraud insurance companies, is in interstate commerce?
So you're saying that his very activity is interstate. And so his activity is what you look at, rather than the bill rate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
I kind of like that, but...
It would probably be an excellent argument. It was, in fact, the holding of this court in Jones. It was, however, reversed.
Well, we stuck with the Supreme Court decision, unfortunately. So,
yeah.
And the arguments about profit and that, I think that you recognize that obviously many nonprofit organizations and things can be within interstate commerce. So I think the argument he makes about that Mr. Nass wasn't profiting, I think he was, otherwise he had two mortgages to pay, so he was profiting. I think I'll move on then to another question.
I'm curious about your actuary.
Yes,
but, I should have looked at this, but I didn't. So what did he, I'm just saying, how did, what was his, what was the basis on which he made this computation?
What he did, Judge, is he took the residential fire data, fires that happened each year, each month, for the period of time, when we started in April, I believe, in 1989, which is when Mr. Vasey moved into his first house.
All the residential fires in the United States for this period?
Correct, Judge.
Wouldn't you want to make a more refined assessment? I mean, presumably fires are more common in cheaper houses, I assume, something like that. Maybe there are regional differences.
Absolutely. All that's true, Judge, and that's what we were really trying to eliminate, all things being equal. We actually, one of the things we argued was, when we wanted to put this evidence in, is that certainly Mr. Vasey was free to argue that, you know, he's a smoker, that he lived in an area where there were more fires. Just that there are factors that...
Do we know, generally, you're putting your finger on the aspect of this calculation that most disturbed me, the implicit proposition that the four events are independent, right? Suppose careless people just have more fires. They continuously miswire their houses and they burn down. What do we know about the probability that if your house burns down, you will have another house burned down? And it, right, in the category of people who no one has ever accused of being arsonists, what's that problem?
We have no information on that, Judge, but that's it.
And isn't this calculation utterly useless?
No, I don't think so.
It depends on an assumption, independence.
Yes.
That, of which there is no support in the record. And your expert gave no reason for believing that the events are independent.
Well, exactly. But I think that you have to eliminate all, any non-independent factor, including careless people. Because that, otherwise, well, first of all, I don't think they have a residential fire trouble for something like that. But the whole point...
insurance companies would.
Yes. They want to know what rate to charge people who have carelessly allowed a house to burn down. Is it the same rate as people who have never had a house on fire?
I don't know, but the answer probably is...
That is fire for much the same reason that your auto insurance rates rise if you've had an accident. You're identified as a careless person. And if auto insurance companies... I have that auto insurance companies have super information about this, and I'd be really surprised if insurance companies didn't have information about it.
Well, I don't know the answer.
The one thing we know is that your expert made an assumption that is almost certainly factually incorrect.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if that's... I would argue that the assumptions he made... I don't know if it's an assumption or it's just the manner in which he went about this, which was he wasn't going to take any factors other than the rant that the fires occurred. And nothing, regional differences, as you mentioned, type of structure, you know, what kind of house you have. Is it a wood house? Is it a brick house? Is it a big house? Is it in a ghetto? Is it in a rich part of the town? He was going to take all that out. These are all things that could have been brought up, though. As a kind of a way to attack the number it came up with.
This doesn't sound very persuasive. What you're saying is that the prosecutor wants to put in evidence he knows is wrong. It's much too simple. It omits critical information. Indeed, we trumpet it as the virtue that our analysis is clearly incorrect. And now it's the defendant's job to figure out what a correct analysis would have been.
Well, I'm not saying, and I know that you think I'm saying that, but I'm not saying
that's
that
exactly
we...
exactly what you're
well,
saying.
I'm not saying...
We've eliminated all of the information that might conduce to an accurate analysis, and now we want the defendant to come up with that information.
No,
why
I think it's an answer...
way to run a criminal trial.
Well, it was an answer to what we perceive to be one of the arguments we're going to get, which is, I am unlucky, and these are random events. So it was really a way to meet that, Judge. Not that I'm a smoker, not that I live in a wooden house, or that I'm careless. I'm unlucky. And so that was one way of doing it. And just let me say this. This was just a very small part of our case. I believe it was helpful to the jury, because I think what you have is... I'm sorry, Judge, interrupt.
Yeah, I just had one question. You said his calculations were peer-reviewed. What did that consist of?
Well, what it consisted of is he had two different individuals that he worked with in his firm.
Just to check the numbers.
Check the numbers.
Not the underlying premise or fact.
Not the underlying.
They all knew how to take an incorrect number to the fourth power. It's really simple.
So I thought maybe when it was peer review, because it was unclear, that maybe some entity outside of his own shop had...
No.
Or there were some standards, perhaps. That
he did two different individuals.
I just wanted to
check his numbers in a different way. And
speaking of insurance companies, it is extraordinary. Is there anything in this record about the extraordinary carelessness of the insurance companies?
Yes, Judge. What we learned about, in this case, what I learned about this case is that it is easier to drop someone from your roles than to do a thorough investigation and maybe prevent this from going on again. We saw over and over again that they were very willing, because a residential fire and a loss is much smaller, it's a small little loss in their eyes, to go ahead and pay an investigative company, an arson investigator, to fully go through all this, and then they feel they might still have to pay. They decide rather to pay it.
I was thinking actually less than that. There is not any kind of national pooling of information.
Yes,
so
there is.
That you know that the person you're being asked to insure has had three fires in the last 6 years.
There absolutely is. And if you looked at Mr. Vase's, it would say that he had fire damage from lightning on one house, which was real. That was actually a real event. And other than that, it had none of the other fires, which we found very surprising.
You're saying that the defendant committed fraud.
Yes.
You know, but the insurance does... But you're saying the insurance companies do not report to some central clearinghouse the fact that their insured had a fire.
They do, Judge. There is a clearinghouse.
Does that mean these insurance companies knew that he had this history?
They did not. What happened, and he lied on some of his applications, but what happened is you have to have someone, Judge, who enters that information into that system.
Yeah.
And what happened is no one did that.
The insurance companies did not enter it.
Yes. It's as good as the information, and they did not enter that information into the
Have
system.
The insurance companies been sued by anybody who incurred losses here?
No. No.
Or by their investors.
Could you get to the sentencing?
Yes.
Because he didn't argue any guideline violation. In terms of the grouping, were there any problems with the fact that the court didn't group and just did consecutive counts? I understand he didn't make that argument. I understand
right.
He's made Apprendi. I don't think he goes anywhere on that. I was just curious with respect to grouping.
No, there really wasn't.
I think this 5G... 1.2 is pretty clear, and there's no definition of what total punishment is in the guidelines, right?
Right.
That number is what the court determines is the total punishment.
Yes.
And so the court could just be guided by the homicide.
Yes, and the total punishment in this case was life imprisonment. And so he was sentenced by Judge Paul Meyer to 110 years, which was the maximum on all the counts of conviction. No other questions?
So it didn't violate any grouping rules?
No grouping, no Apprendi. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Lyons. Mr. Gavert, how much time does he have? No time. Well, if you'd like a minute, we'll give you a minute to reply.
No.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you not?